Next case for argument is Corman versus International Union. Mr. Kaiser.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Charles Kaiser, and I represent the appellant, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. The undisputed material facts of this case demonstrate that the Court should compel Appellee R.J. Corman to arbitrate a post-expiration grievance that concerns contractual wages that Corman failed to pay to covered bargaining unit employees while the collective bargaining agreement was still in effect.
Mr. Kaiser, let me tell you what I think is a difficulty here in your position. It's so open-ended. Once the collective bargaining agreement expires, you either want us to go all the way out to this 10-year Illinois general contract statute of limitations or possibly to infinity in terms of the time to raise this kind of claim. And I have to say, looking at these records that Mr. Fagan got in February 2000, these people who were the casuals do jump off the page at you. And indeed, Mr. Fagan himself seems to have been alerted to the fact that something was wrong. So even if the normal sequencing of the grievance procedure doesn't happen, isn't there a serious question as to how long this arbitration commitment from the now expired contract continues? And shouldn't it be, as the district judge said, a reasonable time?
No, Your Honor. The position of Local 150 is that a reasonable analysis does not apply to a breach of a collective bargaining
agreement.
That's
your infinity argument that I'm very uncomfortable with.
And, Your Honor, we're not arguing for infinity. What we're arguing for is the same amount of time that any other contracting party would have to file for a breach of a straight-up breach of a collective bargaining agreement. And that's
but isn't
what
that directly
here.
Contrary to the labor law policies requiring rapid resolution of these claims or these tight six-month statutes of limitations, other periods of time? And even if that in itself doesn't apply, labor law has its own, as I hardly need to tell you, has its own elaborate set of rules about these things.
That is correct. And labor law encourages parties to resolve their disputes through arbitration, and that is exactly what we attempted to do here. When we became aware and we had knowledge of the contract breach, we filed a grievance pursuant to our contractual obligation to file a grievance.
But your position is you could have waited 10 years.
Our position is that we should have, any labor union should have as much time as any other contracting party.
Ten years.
10 years, correct. Unless the parties contract around that, and that did not happen in this case.
Could I ask you a factual question? I'm not sure if the record reflects this, but this case and its companion, the Dugan case, have all been about these alleged casual workers who turns out really should have been classified as regular workers. My questions are, one, would you back at the time have considered them to be part of the collective bargaining unit if they were casuals and not regulars? And would they have been, I mean, do you ordinarily give copies of the CBA to virtually everybody at a workplace, or do you give them only to the union members? Would these people have had any reason to have seen the CBA?
They would not have had a reason to see the collective bargaining agreement.
So they wouldn't have had any reason getting their paychecks during the months and years that they got paychecks to look at the check and say, gee, I'm not getting paid $18 an hour or whatever it was.
That is correct, because they were classified as casuals, in some instances assistant superintendents, and those classifications were exempt from the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay. But that still leaves me with the February 2000. That's why I've, at least myself, focused on the February date, not the earlier dates, because there's no dispute that Mr. Fagan gets the payroll records that are complete records in February, so he sees how each individual is being paid. That's why he asks, right?
He becomes suspicious. That's correct. And indeed, those
and
documents.
Looking at the records, you can see some of them have, you know, so many hours of rec work and so many hours of non-rec work and so many hours of shop or whatever they, I forget what it's called, regular work.
Those documents, those payroll documents, do not show the classification of the employees. And
but they do show that some people are getting paid dramatically less than other people.
They show that some people were getting paid less than other people, but what was going on was not clear at that time and required an audit, and that's exactly what Local 150 did. Local 150 took possession of these documents and became suspicious that something was going wrong.
But there was only one audit, right? I mean, you've sort of slid over this. You know, we have, in, of course, the pension case that was going on. I can't see any evidence of two different audits going on.
In the record, Your Honor, there is a certification from the auditor who conducted the audit in this case. There was a separate and distinct wage audit that Local 150 initiated. The auditor says so, and also Local 150 Representative Dave Fagan says so in the record. That audit was twofold.
Was it done at the same time?
It was done at
the,
it was done at the same time.
The same people putting one hat on and taking another hat off?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
One set of documents to generate efficiency. One set of documents used to generate the fringe benefit analysis, and then another set of documents used to generate the wage analysis. And as it relates to that audit, the auditors consistently asked for additional payroll documents because the auditors themselves couldn't conclude what the issue was based on the documents that they had before them. And Corman continued to refuse to provide those documents. And hence, when the audit report findings on the wages issues, it issues in July 2001, it's incomplete.
It's the same day as the pension audit, though, right? I was looking at the record. It looks to me like they're both on July 23rd or something.
I believe that is accurate. But the wage audit results are partial and only cover the preceding year. If I may, reasonable analysis is not appropriate in this case.
Why didn't you file your grievance then? The grievance doesn't come along until a little bit later.
The grievance was filed in September of 2001. We filed the grievance in September of 2001 after reviewing the results of the audit. Again, if the issue is whether Local 150 filed the grievance within X amount of days after receiving the audit results, it's Local 150's position that is a procedural question, whether or not we met the bargain for procedural steps in the collective bargaining agreement, and that is something that the arbitrator should decide. When this case was last here before this court sent it back and charged the district court with determining whether the subject matter of the grievance was subject to arbitration, whether the parties agreed to arbitrate the issue. And the parties did agree to arbitrate the issue. If you look at the language in the collective bargaining agreement covering the scope, Corman agreed to arbitrate all disputes unless there is express or negation or clear implication to the contrary. He has to go to arbitration to arbitrate this post-expiration grievance. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kaiser.
Thank you.
Mr. Hellenhaus?
May it please the Court. Very briefly, I want to address three issues that were raised by Local 150. First, it was an issue raised by Judge Wood. The first contract actually did explicitly cover casuals. In later versions or amendments to it, they were excluded.
But that was a difficulty I had with the gist of your argument, because as of the time we seem to be dealing with here, it's not at all clear to me that the casuals would have been walking around with a copy of the CBA in their back pocket and thus would have had any reason to suspect that their paychecks were wrong.
I understand your concern in that regard, but there was also a union steward on the premises.
But he's not paying attention to the non-union people for the most part. He's paying attention to the union people. I suppose his only concern would be whether bargaining unit work is being given to the wrong people or what have you. But his job is basically to deal with union things. I just wasn't terribly moved by the idea that in this factual situation, these people would have had any notice on a week-to-week basis or whatever the...
I understand the concern with that argument, but that still doesn't...
That's why I've kind of moved up to the February date as one that seemed to me more unequivocal, if you will.
Well, let me go back to their main argument, which there is no substantive reasonable time requirement in which to demand arbitration. That's really based on two faulty premises. One is that the presumption of arbitrability even applies, and two, that once the presumption of arbitrability arises, it continues.
But there was an agreement to arbitrate. A CBA is, among other things, an agreement between a union and an employer. And it's very common for the arbitration part of an agreement to survive the termination of the rest of the agreement. And indeed, we have Supreme Court cases to that effect. So why does this get treated as a second-class agreement for purposes of Illinois law?
Well, it depends why the duty to arbitrate continues. The duty to arbitrate expires with the collective bargaining. The express agreement to arbitrate expires with the collective bargaining agreement. That does not mean, however, that the duty to arbitrate is not presumed. And that comes up, for example, in Nolde, where you have rights that were vested under the collective bargaining agreement but would not ripen until after the collective bargaining agreement expired. In that instance, and it was an instance in Young Radiator, a Seventh Circuit case, in those instances, it is reasonable to presume that the parties agreed to arbitrate disputes that vested while during the life of the collective bargaining agreement, where the parties had contemplated that those rights would not ripen until after the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement. And it's reasonable to presume that because the parties provided for arbitration of other vested rights.
But the right to get proper wages vested during the period of time, and if, unlike sort of ripening later, if the reason somebody didn't know about it is the employer's improper classification, some wrongdoing on the part of the employer, then why shouldn't that similarly survive?
It only survives if you can apply the presumption, and I would say that would be a at some point the presumption of arbitrability expires, and several courts have picked up on the reasonable time language in Nolde to say if the demand for arbitration was not made within a reasonable time, that presumption expires.
And but why shouldn't we take into account the fact that it's Corman who was not classifying these people properly?
I would say that is in the nature of a defense to the expiration of the or tolling of the presumption of arbitrability.
But you're also arguing that you want people to kind of zoom off and file lawsuits the second there's a whisper of a reason to do it, namely immediately after this February 22nd, 2000 date, not to wait and do a thorough investigation, wait another year for the audit. They do act very promptly after the audit comes in.
Well, first of all,
they're not trying to wait till 10 years. They get the evidence from the audit, and they say, fine, okay, we've got enough now, let's go.
But there's two points you have to remember. First of all, the parties contemplated a very swift grievance policy, so you would expect them, they anticipate it, and should have acted very promptly.
How are they supposed to do it when the information is in Corman's hands and it's not turning it over?
Well, by February of 2000, they certainly knew at that point, and also if there was any doubt in July of 2001, they should have known.
But they do ask for arbitration within a few months. July 25th, they demand arbitration October 30th, after they have actually filed a grievance, and there are these letters. See, Corman knows that the game's afoot after the July.
Well, they know in September of 2001.
Right, September the 12th.
Yes.
So.
But that's still long after July date, and when you given in the context,
everyone's on vacation in August. It's not really that long.
And given the context of you're dealing with an expired collective bargaining agreement, you'd anticipate that they would even act quicker. If you don't put any limitation on the presumption of arbitrability, then the presumption runs forever.
I guess what I'm trying to explore is even if we agreed with you and the district court that there is some broadly phrased reasonableness limitation, why doesn't Local 150 satisfy that since they moved as promptly as they did after the July 25 audit report, first to send you notice of the grievance and then to follow through in fairly short order with the arbitration request?
Well, that first assumes that they knew nothing before. They weren't in a position to grieve it earlier. The audit issue is really a red herring. Yes, in the Dugan litigation, the trustee had, that was his remedy, to conduct an audit. The remedy in this situation was to file a grievance to figure out what the problem was, if there is one, and remedy the situation. They didn't do that. Furthermore, they didn't communicate anything to Corman during the course of that audit, during the 18 months or 15 months, whatever it works out to be, that there may have been a dispute with respect to wage underpayments. In contrast, the trustees in Dugan did communicate that. And they certainly could have put Corman on notice at a much earlier date. Certainly they knew they were looking at this information, at least if you take what they say at face value, that they did conduct an independent audit, which we do not concede. But at some point, the presumption of arbitrability ends, and there's two aspects of that, when it begins to run and when should it end. I argue that most of the cases talk about it should begin to run from the collective bargaining agreement's expiration, but I think a fairer way for both sides would be to have that time period run from when the vested rights were to ripen. That way it gives the employee the opportunity to submit a claim for arbitration, and it also protects against the employer unilaterally changing or terminating vested rights just based on some time period after the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement. And that was one of the concerns the Seventh Circuit had in Young Radiator.
Of course, we didn't even know until June 2000 that there wasn't going to be a continuation of the CBA. That's when impasse gets reached. That's when Corman says we're going to shut down the Gary derailment division. So, you know, there are a lot of dates floating around here that may have some relevance.
Well, there are, but in terms of that status quo period, I'll call it, the duty to arbitrate does not continue during that period. There's no obligation under the NLRA to arbitrate post-expiration.
But this wasn't post-expiration conduct. This is pre-expiration failure to pay the proper wages.
And they also vested pre-expiration. I want to talk real briefly about the statute of limitations issue. The district court never reached that. And I think it's important to point out that a breach of a collective bargaining agreement, the employees would still have an action for a breach of collective bargaining agreement, and the statute of limitations for that is 6 months. I believe it's under Section 302 of the Labor Management Relations Act. So it's not as if the employees aren't left without a remedy. Here, there is some dispute over whether or when the statute of limitations began to run, but there's no dispute that at least began to run when Corman filed its initial action in January of 2002. Yet, it still took another 18 months before Local 150 filed its action to compel arbitration, and they had plenty of opportunities to file a counterclaim or bring an independent action during that time period. So for no other reason, the district court should be affirmed on the statute of limitations basis. I see my time is up.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Allen. Mr. Kaiser, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Thank you. If I could for a moment address counsel's last argument, and that is the statute of limitations of 6 months on action to compel arbitration. Given the circumstances of this case, Local 150 was filed its action to compel when it was appropriate to do so. This case was resolved initially in March of 2002, and which generated the first appeal of this case. We won at that point. 3 weeks later, Corman filed his appeal in the Seventh Circuit, and it took until last year for the decision to come back. And once the decision came back, we filed our counterclaim. And I'll remind the court that sort of a funky posture that this case took. We never answered previously because of the series of steps that Corman took. When we had an opportunity to answer, we answered and we filed our counterclaim. Also, if I could address the issue of whether or not Local 150 was reasonable, we were certainly reasonable to file when we did, given Corman's delay of the audit. We were certainly reasonable given the complexity of the issue, trying to figure out who was covered by the collective bargaining agreement. And also, one other point, this case falls squarely under Litton. It involves a contractual right that vested while the contract was in agreement, was in effect, and it involves a breach while the contract was in effect. The presumption survives. And indeed, this case in Young Radiator said that in that set of circumstances, the presumption does not weaken as the time between the expiration of the grievance and, the expiration of the contract and the filing of the grievance increases. And that makes eminent sense because a contract expires does not relieve a party from its bargaining for obligation.
Isn't it Young though that imposed the reasonable time limitation?
In Young Radiator?
Yes.
I believe the reasonableness standard comes from this court's decision in Kennecott, which is a case where...
Do you accept it as the correct rule?
The reasonableness standard?
Yes.
I would accept it not for this case.
Why not for this case?
Because the reasonableness rule does not apply to a breach of a collective bargaining agreement that occurred while the agreement was in effect. The reasonableness analysis applies.
I thought it applied whenever the collective bargaining agreement expired. Once it expires, you have to move within a reasonable time to resolve these disputes.
No, Your Honor, it's our position that a reading of Nolde Brothers Bakery and a reading of this court's decision in Kennecott and also a reading of the Ninth Circuit case in Goss shows that the reasonableness analysis only applies to those grievances that are filed post-expiration that concern employers' post-expiration conduct.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To both parties. Next case for argument.